Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated July 17th, 2015. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's lead article, North Carolina's win-loss record, 8,820 home, 16,580 away. In 2014, the Tar Heel State scored 8,820 jobs from economic development projects while losing 16,580 to other states. Are we competitive enough? This week's cover story is written by Jason DeBrun. He's entitled it North Carolina's EcoDevo Scorecard. Small projects won and large projects lost in 2014 reveal the state may need to strengthen its game to remain a contender. In Plano, Texas, Town Mayor Harry LaRossier and Jim Lentz, CEO of Toyota North America, bumped fists in June while posing for a photo with Toyota's new iRoad electric vehicle. Those attending the Texas celebration held a festive mood, but economic developers in North Carolina would likely rather not think too much about that photo or the event. That's because Toyota last year decided to move its North American headquarters from Los Angeles to Plano, investing north of $300 million there and pledging 3,000 jobs to the area. It stings North Carolina because the Tar Heel State was in the running for that project. Governor Pat McCrory and the North Carolina Department of Commerce like to tout business expansions but rarely speak about their overall win-loss record. Here's the tale of the tape. In 2014, Commerce announced 47 relocation or expansion projects that promised to bring 8,820 jobs and capital investments of nearly $1.4 billion. On the losing side, North Carolina was in the running for 23 projects that ultimately went elsewhere. Those projects promised 16,580 jobs and investments of nearly $1.9 billion. North Carolina has what it takes to make it on every list for company relocations and expansions. We would love to win every single project, but realistically you can't win them all, says Commerce Secretary John Sclavara. What we need is certainty and flexibility for North Carolina's job recruitment efforts to get us to the finals and across the goal line. When looking at what companies value, executives harp on three major topics: workforce, tax incentives and tax rates, and infrastructure, or as Hartmut Label, CEO of I-Corps, a company that chose St. Petersburg, Florida over North Carolina for a $10 million expansion, said at the announcement, "The region's large pool of highly skilled talent, strong business climate, and outstanding infrastructure will support I-Corps' increasing scale and culture of innovation." And given the emphasis company executives say they place on tax rate, North Carolina could soon become more competitive. After all, the corporate tax rate could soon drop to as low as 3%, down from 6% in 2014, thanks to changes recently passed by North Carolina leaders. Determining why North Carolina won or lost any individual project, or even drawing broad conclusions from the overall record, can be challenging. Transportation access, cash on the table, and even same-sex marriage rights can influence a company's geographic decision. Often a combination of factors involved, and private companies often shy away from divulging many details about choosing one state over another. For example, San Francisco law firm Sedgwick LLP opened a back office operations in Kansas City primarily as a cost-saving move, continuing a trend to move non-legal jobs to lower-cost regions. Commenting on location choice, Sedgwick Chief Marketing Officer Chris Carter said Sedgwick toured and evaluated three shortlist locations, including Raleigh. "We ultimately selected Kansas City because it was the best fit for the firm's needs." Through a Freedom of Information Act request, Triangle Business Journal obtained a list of companies that considered expanding in North Carolina last year. Due to laws protecting the privacy of negotiations with private companies, the list of losses could actually be higher than what was reported by Commerce. Tax incentives play a role in some projects, but not in others, at least based on how private companies tell the story. Consider Stone Brewing, which chose Richmond, Virginia over North Carolina for a new brewery. I can definitely confirm that we were exploring North Carolina as a possible location for our East Coast brewery. However, we did not enter a discussion regarding possible incentives. Being awarded incentives had no impact on our decision to locate in North Carolina, wrote Stone Brewing's Nikki Pina in an email. We decided with Richmond because of their ability to meet our extensive site requirements outlined in the request for proposal issued last year, and also felt that Richmond's vibrant energy and impressive craft beer culture would allow us to create a truly memorable Stone experience. Of course, the fact that companies don't base their decisions entirely on incentives can benefit North Carolina as well. Consider HCL, which could have received a sweeter deal monetarily from a different state. New York offered the tech company $56.9 million in incentives. By contrast, with state and local incentives, HCL could earn up to $21.4 million in incentives by moving to North Carolina if it achieves all its goals. That said, Arizona offered $5.6 million, and Texas offered $9.8 million, so it's not a stretch to say incentives at least play some role. The role of incentives still are very important, and I don't want to discount the importance that companies do put on them, said Brent Batis, Executive Vice President and Principal with Dallas-based Site Selection Group, which helps companies as they look to expand or relocate. Incentives will always play an important role in the overall decision process. It's more of a question as to when they are important, Batis says. In the early stages, when a company is considering 10 or even 15 sites, workforce availability and labor costs matter far more. When it gets narrowed down to 3 or 4, that's when company executives look at money. The driving factor for any project is going to be labor, Batis says. Truly, the labor availability and labor cost is what is going to make the biggest impact. North Carolina has historically shown strength in its labor pool, but it could become an area of concern. Without question, education begets qualified workers, something the education industry doesn't hesitate to shout from every figurative mountaintop. According to an economic impact study conducted by Economic Modeling Specialists International, also known as EMSI, the University of North Carolina system, the North Carolina Community College System, and the 36 campuses of North Carolina independent colleges and universities in the state together created $63.5 billion in added economic value during fiscal year 2012 and 2013. While taxpayers invested $4.3 billion to support higher education in North Carolina during fiscal year 2012-13, the return on that investment totaled $17 billion, according to the study. For years, state leaders like former Governor Jim Hunt have plowed state resources into public education, but more recently, that funding has come under the microscope. As it stands, North Carolina is still a relatively inexpensive state to attend public universities, but costs are going up. As tuition costs rise, so does student debt, meaning they need higher salaries right out of school to afford the same quality of life. From Batis's perspective, however, the funding pendulum has not swung too far. The Triangle is a still very attractive market with our clients, he says. The universities are one of the big strong points. Still, comparing what is cost to employ a given workforce isn't an exact science. Area unemployment rates, cost of living, commute time, and other factors all play a role. Comparing states to each other is equally inexact, especially when considering North Carolina's economic spectrum, which includes high-tech jobs in the Triangle, banking jobs in Charlotte, and agricultural jobs in the eastern half of the state. We do have such a diverse state economy, says PNC economist Michael Testome. There just aren't any formal measures, but just covering so many different regions, it feels more bifurcated than a lot of other places. North Carolina seems to stand out a little more to me. The average income of all North Carolina workers in 2012 was $41,146, according to the most recent data available from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. That ranks North Carolina as the fourth highest in the 11-state Southeast region, according to an analysis done by Max Gulker of the American Institute for Economic Research. After the availability of a qualified workforce and manageable labor cost, the discussion pivots back to incentives, which means politics, especially since one of North Carolina's biggest cooperative incentives grant program, the Jobs Development Investment Grant, maxed out its $22.5 million funding account. The JDIG, as it is known, since its inception in 2002, has been used by state economic development recruiters to sweeten the pot for companies considering a major investment in North Carolina that would lead to the creation of net new jobs in the state. JDIG has typically been reserved for the largest new job deals, and payouts are made only after the company reaches a minimum job creation goal. But that fund is now dried up, and lawmakers can't agree on whether or not to put money back into the kitty. Sclavara, former Commerce Secretary Sharon Decker, who headed the Commerce Department in 2014, and McCrory want to pump funds back into the program, but some legislatures, especially in the Senate, want to invest that money elsewhere, for example, on programs to improve the workforce. Even if the legislature decides to not fund JDIG, Commerce leaders say they just want a decision to be made because the indecisiveness hurts North Carolina's economic development efforts. What we need now is legislative action to provide certainty on our economic development strategy because we've been waiting for more than 6 months, and that puts us at a competitive disadvantage with other states, says Josh Ellis, McCrory's communication director. In terms of corporate tax rate, North Carolina is headed towards becoming one of the lowest in the nation. In 2014, the corporate tax rate was 6%, not very different from many of its neighbors. However, a $400 million expected surplus announced by McCrory puts North Carolina on track to trigger automatic cuts to the state's corporate tax in coming years. Under the tax reform package adopted in 2013, the state's corporate tax rate is automatically lowered by 1% if tax revenues exceed $20.2 billion by the end of 2014-15 fiscal year. The rate would drop by an additional 1% of tax revenues reached $21 billion by the end of 2015-2016 fiscal year. The corporate tax rate in 2015 is 5%. Meaning if both targets are reached, the rate would drop from 6% in 2014 to 3% in 2017. When luring companies that generate millions or more in profits, changes in the corporate tax rate of even a quarter of a percent can make a difference. It is a significant number, says Tesson, the PNC economist, though agrees with Bates and other experts that the tax rate is not the end-all, be-all in economic development. I think what matters most is the overall picture, he says. It's really more about the entire package that you are selling to the company. Although North Carolina lost out on projects with more jobs and a higher total investment, it's important to note that the state is competitive, often on the short list of states companies are considering. In addition to receiving the prestigious Forbes ranking as number 3 for business, the state was recently named a Silver Shovel Award winner in the 8 to 12 million population category by Area Development Magazine for its 2014 economic development wins. Two of the top 10 projects last year factored into the award were in the Triangle, Advance Auto Parts for bringing 600 jobs to Wake County, and HCL Technologies for bringing 1,237 jobs to Wake County. Moreover, total employment in North Carolina has steadily increased since the bottom of the recession. Combining the 47 projects won and the 23 lost, that's more than one project per week that the state is in play. In addition, South Carolina won two of the big projects that are just across the state line and still considered part of the Charlotte Metro. In that situation, South Carolina reaps the tax revenue based on the investment, but also gives the incentive while the company still pulls from North Carolina to find workers. South Carolina is making an incentive offer based on getting all of the jobs, says Sharon Decker, the former Commerce Secretary. We work aggressively to try to keep the jobs themselves, but if you haven't lost it all, if a company locates just across the state line. In other cases, like the Toyota project, executives listed the time zone as a deciding factor, along with a closer proximity to Japan, two things North Carolina can obviously not improve. Decker says that a state's infrastructure is key and that North Carolina must continue to invest in itself. I think that we have to make very careful strategic investments, she says. North Carolina is a fabulous place to live and work. Continuing on to real estate, covered by Amanda Hoyle, Biologics gets a new headquarters and plans to hire. Less than 2 weeks after the executives and staff of Biologics Incorporated began moving their headquarters operations into the company's new 76,000-square-foot office building on Weston Parkway in Cary, Biologics is already making plans for its next big expansion. The oncology services company plans to hire another 175 employees in 2015 with an additional 175 new hires in 2016. The expansion would bring the company's total employee count to more than 700 people. Biologics has already grown its employee base 400% in the past 5 years, from 68 people with the Cary-based company in 2010 to 350 full-time employees to date, says President and CEO Stuart France. The company will be keeping possession of its old headquarters building at 120 Weston Oaks Court, less than 2 miles away. France says they are also looking for more office space to lease nearby for expansion, as well as plans to open a West Coast distribution facility in the first quarter of 2016. And Forever Home snags a Raleigh investor. Raleigh businessman and real estate investor David Stallings has emerged as a new investor and white knight for the ailing Raleigh home building company Forever Home LLC, with plans to first take over development of the builder's newest new home community, Fendall Farms at Briar Creek in Durham. Stallings has entered into a joint venture partnership with Rialto Capital Management of Miami to complete development of the 433-lot community on 182 acres on Leesville Road. Stallings is also forming his own home construction company, Shenandoah Homes, LLC, that will be building more than half of the homes planned at Fendall Farms. Stallings says he also is still in negotiations with Forever Home to buy more of its inventory of residential housing lots in the state, but he could not yet disclose details of that plan. Mick Michael, formerly general manager of H.H. Hunt Homes and vice president of operations at Syntex Homes in the Triangle, has been hired as an interim chief operating officer at Shenandoah Homes. Stallings and his holding company, Capital Properties of Raleigh, have been buying properties from banks and other lenders in Wake and Johnston County since 2011. There's a new expansion. Raleigh pharmacy services firm ATEB Incorporated has filed plans to nearly double the size of its headquarters building in the North Raleigh less than a year after the company moved in. ATEB recently completed the relocation of its staff of 150 people to the new 38,000-square-foot building at 11125 Forest Pines Drive near Wakefield, and now the company has filed plans with the city to add another 27,271 square feet to the building structure. The company has, in the past 4 years, more than doubled its employees base to 150 people from 70 that were employed in 2011. Jason DeBruin's column on healthcare leads with an article, Working to End Hearing Loss. Research Triangle Park's Fennec Pharmaceuticals Incorporated reported positive safety data on an experimental drug that could prevent hearing loss in pediatric cancer patients. Fennec is developing a drug that would prevent hearing loss in patients who receive cisplatin, a common treatment that attacks cancers in children. While cisplatin does a good job fighting cancer, it also causes hearing loss in children, something Fennec's drug would prevent. The Fennec Fox, originating from Saharan North North Africa, has distinctly large ears that dissipate heat and provide very sensitive hearing, leading the company to use it as its name and its logo. The company changed its name from Adherix in late 2014. The market for Fennec's drug would be relatively small, about 2,000 patients in the United States, 2,500 in Europe, and 3,000 in the rest of the world. The company received orphan drug designation from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, meaning the agency recognizes it affects only a small population, but gives Fennec more than 7 years of market exclusivity in the United States upon approval. Furthermore, Fennec executives don't anticipate immediate competition. Already, Fennec has completed 2 phase 3 trials, one in the United States that took 6 years to enroll 135 patients, and one in Europe that took 8 years to enroll 130 patients. Enrollment is difficult because of the small patient populations. When testing new pharmaceuticals in patients, drug companies typically conduct trials in 3 phases. Phase 3 being the most advanced. Fennec hasn't released pricing targets, but executives point out that hearing aids can cost up to $10,000 and need to be replaced periodically, and a cochlear implant can run a price tag of as much as $75,000. Next up, Bill Hoover, the Hillcrest CFO and co-owner, has been quoted as saying, "We've been looking heavily at the Raleigh market, and this opportunity presented itself. We felt like this location was suitable for us." Hillcrest Convalescent Center in Durham has acquired the 134-bed Crabtree Valley Rehab Facility in Raleigh. The first expansion acquisition, Hillcrest bought the property from Traditions Senior Management, a Clearwater, Florida-based senior living management group. Hoover owns Hillcrest along with his business partner, Ted Smith, the CEO. Their families have owned Hillcrest since the 1950s. Crabtree Valley Rehab sits off Blue Ridge Road on the hill just above Crabtree Valley Mall. "We are 20 to 25 minutes down the road," he said. "We feel like we know North Carolina, and we know this location." Continuing on, Jason DeBruin's column on healthcare, Orange County gets okay for 84 more beds. State health care regulators have determined a need for 84 new hospital beds in Orange County, a move that will likely pique the interest of health systems around the state. The North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services regulates much of the health care provided in North Carolina and allows health systems only a limited number of certain assets, including acute care hospital beds. These regulations go by the name Certificate of Need, or CON, for short. Supporters of CON, which include hospitals themselves, say they keep costs in check because it prevents an overabundance of services and allows hospitals revenue to cover for uncompensated care. Detractors say it actually elevates prices because it doesn't allow the free market to take control. The debate took center stage at times during legislative budget discussions, though this year's debate applied more specifically to CON regulations of operating rooms, not hospital beds. Under current law, the state must determine a need for additional beds if a health system wants to add them. In 2016, the state determined Orange County will need 84 more hospital beds. According to the preliminary state medical facilities plan, the master document that controls all CON-related services. Only UNC Healthcare owns any acute beds in the entire county. It has 724 beds at UNC hospitals and will add 42 at its main campus and another 68 inpatient beds and 15 outpatient beds when the Hillsborough campus ramps to full operation. UNC Hospitals runs at about a 90% occupancy rate. Health systems compete fiercely for these beds. In a very real way, these acute care beds can be viewed as the most important asset a health system has. A hospital may admit only as many patients as it has licensed beds, so a hospital cannot expand inpatient services without more beds. It's true that outpatient services are gobbling up a growing portion of the health care pie, but inpatient services still make up a healthy portion of a hospital's revenue. UNC hospitals performed 12,174 inpatient operations and 17,030 outpatient operations in the fiscal year ended June 30, the most recent year for which comprehensive data is publicly available. However, outpatient cases by definition do not require an overnight hospital stay. For all UNC hospital patients, meaning all stays, not just survey cases, the average length of stay was 6.6 days in 2013, up from 6.1 days in 2011. Because the state will make 84 beds available, it could offer the opportunity for another health system to build a hospital in Orange County to compete with UNC. Though there is a caveat. Although the beds will become available, the state has not made any operating rooms available, and it would be very unlikely for a new hospital to open without an operating room. However, state leaders are seriously considering removing operating rooms from the CON requirements. If that happens, a new hospital would be very much in play for Orange County. Duke Health operates an expansive health system in Durham County, but not in comparison very little in Orange. Winston-Salem-based Novant Health has been looking to break into the Triangle healthcare market in a bigger way for years, but most recently losing a lengthy battle to build a hospital in Holly Springs. By the numbers, licensed acute care beds are by county are as follows. In Durham, 1,258. In Johnston County, 179 acute care beds. Orange County has 724, and Wake County has 1,362 acute care beds. This week's column on technology by Lauren Onisorge has a lead article entitled Watch Concerts Live from Home. Dubbed Torpedo, a Raleigh technology startup founded by software engineers out of auction streaming service Nextlot, is trying to transform the way you watch concerts. Instead of having to dress up, hop an Uber, and pay for a $25 ticket at the Lincoln Theater, theoretically you could buy a $5 online streaming ticket and see your favorite indie artist, all from the comfort of your couch. And with no restrictions per ticket, you can invite the entire neighborhood. Co-founder Matt Henson says his team has bootstrapped hundreds of thousands of dollars to get the company to this point, where it has more than 100 concerts under its belt, including deals with local venues such as Lincoln Theater and the Poorhouse. How, in a world where artists such as Taylor Swift has increasingly criticized streaming services, can Henderson and team make it happen? By venturing outside its Briar Creek office and using its secret weapon, philanthropy. The Black Keys are a prime example. While Torpedo has almost all its headliners of the New York-based Mountain Jam Festival signed on to the stream, the headliners, the Black Keys and Grace Potter, were the holdouts. When they found out about one of Torpedo's partners, Teen Cancer America, a charity that would net the bulk of the proceeds, so they signed on too, and Torpedo was able to write Teen Cancer America a check for about $25,000 from streaming proceeds. The company is about to debut a memorial auction for the Make-A-Wish Foundation that will feature items signed by Dave Matthews and Hall & Oates. But the charities aren't always a part of the plan. Deals are constructed on a per-event basis. Sometimes venues and artists get the bulk of the proceeds, with Torpedo always taking a small cut. Next up, Swedish athletic apparel company launches new Raleigh subsidiary. Meet Salming, a Swedish sports apparel brand known for neon-colored shoes worn by serious athletes. Right now, it's a David in a pool of Goliaths, brands such as Nike and Adidas currently sitting at the top of the market share shelf from apparel centers in Boston and Portland. But eventually, at least to serious runners, Salming hopes to lap the big guns with its scientifically designed products, and it's doing it from Raleigh. That's according to Tor Swenson, the CEO of the brand's new Raleigh-based U.S. subsidiary. He's tasked with taking European sports, think floorball, a game reminiscent of indoor hockey, where Salming has about 80% market share, from obscurity to your local running store. Previously, Swenson owned White Collar Crime, the now-closed dance club located where Crank Arm Brewery is today. For Swenson, the career change was about living a healthier lifestyle, and he has no plans to reverse course. Salming's ultimate goal isn't competing with the Nikes of the world in your local REI or Target. Its focus is on the boutique specialty brands, and even that niche market will be an uphill battle, as its current market share is less than 1%. Grant Sainsbury, Vice President of Advanced Solutions at Dimension Data. He's talking about the Tour de France, which utilized Dimension Data's analytics capabilities to help fans get more engaged in cycling through statistical data. And he was quoted as saying, "We're collecting data on every second on every one of the 198 riders in the Tour de France." Moving deeper into this week's Triangle Business Journal, Lauren Onisorge has a column on entrepreneurship, and her article is entitled, "Date Rape Drug Detecting Nail Polish Begins Testing." Nail polish startup Undercover Colors is officially testing its product, a date rape drug detecting nail polish in spiked drinks. That's according to company co-founder Tyler Comfrey Maloney, speaking about 11 months and more than $1 million after the international blogosphere picked up on the polish being developed at NC State University. What started as an idea to develop a way to alert potential victims of sexual assault dangers at parties skyrocketed into a viral and controversial sensation last August, before the team had even developed a product. Comfrey Maloney confirms the firm has closed on its entire $1.2 million seed round. "This money will be used to finish development of our product," he says, adding that most of the investors are local to the area with ties to NC State. Others have ties to the cosmetic industry. The company, which was completely unknown this time last year, has expanded into 7 full-time employees, mostly chemists operating independent laboratories at NC State's Centennial Campus in Raleigh. And more cash is coming in, solicited through non-tax-deductible donations via its website, which provided enough funding to get the company off the ground and to the investment round, Comfrey Maloney says. He wouldn't be specific about the sum of the donations, nor could he be specific about the status of the ongoing research and development, although he did say product testing is underway in a variety of situations and beverages. Comfrey Maloney and Stephen Gray, co-founder and chief operating officer of Undercover Colors, also volunteer at Wake County Sexual Assault and Domestic Violence Center, Interact. Undercover Colors is but one part of a larger effort to combat sexual violence, Comfrey Maloney says. That effort includes outreach, prevention, victim services, and culture shifting. This week's column on transportation is by Jeff Jeffries, and his lead article is entitled, "Virginia Bound: Proposed Raleigh-Norfolk Interstate Gains Traction in Congress." Legislation to designate the entire highway corridor from Raleigh to Norfolk, Virginia as a future interstate is picking up steam in Congress. The entire North Carolina delegation has now offered support for the bill. U.S. Representatives Virginia Fox and Richard Hudson, both Republicans, had been the final holdouts, but both recently became co-sponsors. If it becomes law, the measure would designate U.S. Route 64 from Raleigh through Rocky Mount, Williamston, and Elizabeth City to U.S. 17 in Norfolk as a high-priority corridor. High-priority corridors are eligible for federal funds to assist states in upgrading highways. Once the segments of U.S. Route 64 and U.S. 17 meet certain requirements, they would become part of the federal interstate system. Daniel Keelan, a spokesman for the United States Senator Tom Tillis, Republican North Carolina, says that the delegation came together because if the roads do become part of the federal interstate system, it could bring significant economic impacts to the region. North Carolinians would see many benefits, including reduced traffic congestions and enhanced interstate commerce between North Carolina and Virginia, Keelan says. The Virginia delegation remains split in their support for the bipartisan legislation, while both of Virginia's Democratic senators have signed on. Just four of the state's 11 representatives in the House are currently co-sponsors. That said, the effort to get the bill signed into law has cleared some procedural hurdles that could ease its passage. The Senate has added language to a highway funding bill that would allow for the high-priority corridor designation. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, has said the Senate will begin debating the transportation legislation in the coming weeks. Members of North Carolina's House delegation are working to get companion language added to the lower chamber's transportation bill. However, that remains a work in progress. State officials from both North Carolina and Virginia have lent their support to the idea of creating a Raleigh-Norfolk corridor. Joe Melzano, executive director of the Regional Transportation Alliance Business Coalition, says connecting the two metropolitan job centers would provide an economic lifeline for northeastern North Carolina and afford several counties their first direct access to the interstate system. And it's construction time in the Triangle area again. North Carolina Department of Transportation has recently awarded three more multi-million-dollar road repair contracts in the Triangle. Carolina Sunrock, LLC of Raleigh. $2 million to repair 19 miles of roadway around Alamance and Orange County. ST Wooten Corporation of Wilson, $2.5 million to repair 12 miles of roads in Lee County. And Johnson Brothers Utilities and Paving Company of Lillington has an $8.1 million contract to resurface nearly 45 miles of roads in Harnett County and other 17.4 miles in Cumberland County. And you may not know it, but the North Carolina Department of Transportation has growing pains, which are driving the need for new Triangle Expressway interchange. Population growth in the Triangle has driven the North Carolina Department of Transportation to embark on the first major expansion of the Triangle Expressway since its final phase was completed in 2013. Construction work is expected to begin later this month on a new interchange on the toll road at Old Holly Springs Apex Road just south of Apex. North Carolina Department of Transportation says the $18.4 million project was necessary due to the increased traffic the toll road is expected to see in the coming decades. Currently, traffic along Old Holly Springs Apex Road amounts to about 1,900 vehicles per day, but by 2035, the number of daily vehicles is expected to grow to 34,900. Wake County's population has grown to nearly 11% since 2010, according to U.S. Census figures. The new interchange is expected to take until May 2017 to finish, but drivers may be able to access the interchange ramps by November of next year. NCDOT says drivers of two-axle vehicles will likely pay 20 cents and 31 cents as the toll rates for each of the new toll zones at the interchange. The project will not affect the price of the entire Triangle Expressway or any other toll rates at existing toll zones. Blythe Construction of Charlotte landed the contract after coming in about $2 million less than anticipated. Still on the subject of transportation, here is North Carolina by the numbers. North Carolina's first wind energy project, which will be built near Elizabeth City, is expected to generate jobs in addition to energy. $400 million, the cost that Portland, Oregon-based Iberdrola Renewables is paying to build the project. $1.1 million, amount of Iberdrola will pay annually in taxes and lease payments. 104 number of turbines that will be built, 250 construction jobs, and 10 permanent jobs. And now the executive voice. This week's person is Ed Auslander. This column is entitled Turning Inventions into Innovations. And this has been written and interviewed and written by Jeff Jeffers. Lord Corporation, or Lord Corp as they're known, CEO Ed Auslander has gotten used to thinking outside the box for a company that does Most of its businesses outside the United States, the economic uncertainty rocking China, Russia, and Europe has meant Lord Corp has had to create opportunities in new markets. The manufacturer of adhesives, coatings, and wireless sensing systems has begun developing products to compete in entirely new industries. Auslander says there's a lot more to come. Triangle Business Journal. When did you begin working at Lord? Mr. Auslander. I was at Penn State for mechanical engineering, and I wanted to do a summer internship. I thought about doing a co-op for GM, but I really liked Lord more for what they did and how they did it. I called them up, and they gave me a position for a summer internship, which was making products on the shop floor, testing them, and working like a technician. After my senior year, I decided to go back full-time. That was in 1985, so I have been here for my entire career. TBJ, how did you rise through the ranks? Mr. Auslander, I was able to do what was almost every 3 years. What I was able to do was almost every 3 years I was in a new job, but in the same company. Lord is so broad that within the businesses of automotive, aerospace, defense, and industrial, I kind of moved around within those businesses. I spent 5 years in Europe in Strasbourg, France, and Manchester, England. By the time I became CEO, I spent time in every single business, in every single market at Lord. TBJ, what can you tell us about some of your products? Mr. Auslander, 55% of our sales are outside the U.S. We're a net exporter. One of the more recent technological innovations in automotive is magnetic suspensions. They talked about that in Fast and Furious 6. The specialty cars had magnetic suspensions. Lord provides the magnetic fluid that enables magnetic suspensions in every car in the world that has it. We also provide the calibration system for the iPhone 6 for the orientation gyro. It's a very broad product base. TBJ, you've been the CEO since 2013. How has the business evolved under your leadership? Mr. Auslander, in the 2000s, when Rick McNeil was the CEO, we were totally focused on emerging markets, the BRIC companies, Southeast Asia, etc. We did very well at that, but you look at the 2010s and what is coming at us in the 2020s, and all of that is slowing down, so we have to change. What we're focusing on is the value that remains in our core markets, but we're looking at expanding into new applications, new products, and new markets. TBJ, how is Lord doing that? Mr. Auslander, one example is that we're taking our aerospace technology and applying it to the oil and gas industry. That's seen a lot of success. We're taking our core adhesive technology and applying that to personal electronics and wearables. TBJ, shortly after you stepped into the CEO role, the company embarked on a $100 million upgrade to its Erie, Pennsylvania facilities. What was the goal of that investment? Mr. Auslander, Lord Corp started in Erie. We had a facility from the 1930s that we had added about 24 times to through 2010. It was at the end of its useful life. A lot of pieces fell together, and we were able to acquire a facility that we could renovate. Now we have a state-of-the-art aerospace facility that is significantly more efficient with better technology and better process controls. TBJ, more recently, the company has been working with aircraft manufacturer Sikorsky on the Kiowa Warrior helicopter for the U.S. Army. Lord has also been working with Curtiss-Wright Corp on wireless sensing solutions. Tell us about the company's approach to business partnerships. Mr. Auslander, part of our strategy update we did when we transitioned CEOs was to make our products more sophisticated. A lot of our customers were asking for more capabilities from our products. They wanted them to be sensorized so they could collect and use data. 3 years ago, we acquired a company called MicroStrain. Their specialty is wireless sensing systems. The two projects you mentioned are built on the MicroStrain capability. The acquisition with MicroStrain started with one of these partnerships, and the relationship grew. One of the key parts of our strategy is to do more with partnerships. TBJ, what are the biggest challenges facing the company? Mr. Auslander, everything that stems from the challenges of growth, developing talent, putting our talent in the right location. As Lord expands, these are new markets for us and we aren't as familiar with them. There is additional risk associated with that. TBJ, as you expand into these new markets, how are you approaching the question of competition? Mr. Auslander, when we move into a new market, we focus on providing more value than what our competitors are providing. Take the decision to move our aerospace industry technology into the oil and gas industry. We used to be in that market in the 1980s, but we decided to get out for various reasons. Now we're moving back in with 25 years of advancements to our materials. Because that market hasn't advanced nearly as fast, it's really provided us with some opportunities. Oil and gas has the potential to double, Lord, in the next few years. TBJ, tell us about your hobbies. Mr. Auslander, I like fishing, both bass fishing and deep sea fishing. I like to golf and connecting with our four kids. TBJ, what are you reading these days? Mr. Auslander, Innovation Quality. It's not available yet in the U.S., but was published in German, and I have an English translation. What's cool about it is that it has a really big connection to Lord. Lord has always talked a lot about the differences between innovation and invention. An invention is just an invention, but an innovation turns into something of value, something that is going to make a difference. This week's Small Business Column is by Mr. James Lee. Mr. Lee is a professor at UNC Chapel Hill University and a family business speaker, author, and advisor. This week's column is entitled Handy Question and Answer on Planning for Growth and Succession. First question. I believe in tradition, but I think our family is running it into the ground. Our $25 million company is locked into outdated operating and management procedures because that's the way Daddy set things up. How can I convince the rest of the family to make some changes without seeming disrespectful of my late father? Answer. It's unlikely that a successful business person like your father would want the family company to go down the drain because his successors failed to modernize and improve its structure, management, and operations. Remind your family that sacrificing the business on the altar of respect for your father isn't a particularly good way to honor his memory. Question. Our company has a succession plan in place, and my children are moving into senior management positions, but I'm worried that when I retire, the company won't be run like it's always been. How can I get my kids to do the things I've done them for the past 40 years? Answer. If you're concerned because the next generation of family managers is sloppy and incompetent, maybe you should take another look at that succession plan. But if you're worried that your successors will manage the business differently from the way you've managed it, try to assess not how, but how well they'll run it when they're in charge. Since you've headed a successful business for 40 years, you must have been doing a lot of things right. On the other hand, if they have the basic skills and experience, there's nothing wrong with the next generation easing into a modified management style and a fresh perspective on the marketplace. During the management transition, all of you should keep an eye on the company's critical performance indicators and judge the new approaches accordingly. Question. Our family business has grown significantly in the past 5 years. Should we be getting professional management help on a regular basis from some of the consulting firms that bombard us with their capability statements? Answer. If the only thing that's wrong with your company growth, we should all have the same problem. There's no rule that says when a family business reaches the 10 million or the 50 million mark, it should start hiring consultants to do its work. Consultants can be useful as management extenders for solving specific problems that the company can't solve with its in-house resources. If your business isn't performing up to its potential and you can't figure out why or what to do about it, then get expert help. But if it ain't broke, don't pay somebody to fix it just because that's what the big companies do. Question. I'd really like to see my kids come to work for my company and eventually take over the management and ownership, but I can't find a way to get them interested. Any suggestions? My book, Keeping It in the Family, Successful Succession in the Family Business, includes a chapter on marketing the business to the family. The chapter discusses things I've learned about how families familiarize younger members with the business, build their understanding and interest, and give them reasons for joining the company and carrying it on. Basically, the approach involves no coercion, no unrealistic incentives, and no after all I've done for you nonsense. I recommend honesty and openly making the family business a more attractive career and lifestyle option than the other options your kid may be considering. Question. I just received in the mail an attractive brochure from a major insurance company. One of the policies it describes looks like the ideal solution to the estate tax problem facing our family business. Any reason why I shouldn't go ahead and buy the policy? Answer. Yes, there is, and it's the same reason why you shouldn't take a correspondence course in surgery and then remove your own appendix. There are some things that really demand expert help. An insurance policy, as the best agents will confirm, is the only one of the tools you may need to carry out your strategic plan for conserving and passing along your estate. The plan is the important thing. Like your family business succession plan, it should be thoughtfully crafted with an eye to protecting long-term business and family interest. In fact, your succession plan and your estate plan will probably interlock at several crucial points. To ensure that they'll accomplish your goals and stand up to the challenge, get legal and tax experts help in putting them together. This week's guest column is by Susan Milner Parrott. Ms. Parrott is a partner at Smith Anderson, where she advises clients on wage and hour matters. Her column is entitled, Proposed Overtime Pay Regulations May Affect Many. On July 6, the Federal Department of Labor published in the Federal Register a notice of proposed rulemaking announcing proposed changes to the overtime pay regulations under the Fair Labor Standards Act to increase the salary threshold for white-collar exemptions from the current level of $23,600 per year to $50,440 per year in 2016. The proposed rule is the result of nearly 16 months of work by the Department of Labor following President Obama's March 13, 2014 directive to the Secretary of Labor to, quote, modernize and streamline, end quote, the current overtime regulations for white-collar employees, generally executive, administrative, and professional employees. The DOL last updated the white-collar overtime regulations in 2004, and that update raised the minimum salary threshold for exemption to the current threshold of $455 per week, $23,660 per year. The proposed rule would set the threshold at the 40th percentile of earnings for full-time salaried workers. That amount is currently $921 per week, $47,892 per year, and the Department of Labor expects it to be $970 per week, $50,440 per year in 2016 when the final rule will be issued. Under the FLSA, an employee must be paid at least the minimum salary threshold on a salary basis and must meet certain job duties tests in order to be exempt from minimum wage and overtime. If an employee is not exempt, either because he or she is not paid the requisite amount on a salary basis or does not satisfy the duties test for a particular exemption, he or she must receive overtime pay at the rate of 1.5 times his regular rate of pay for every hour over 40 in a particular work week. The DOL states that increasing the salary threshold to the 40th percentile of earnings for full-time salaried workers is appropriate, quote, because the current salary level is only screening from exemption approximately 15% of overtime-eligible white-collar salaries employees, end quote. In addition to proposing an increase in the standard salary level, the DOL is also proposing an increase in the annual compensation level required for exemption as a, quote, highly compensated employee, end quote. That level currently, $100,000 per year, would increase to a level equal to the 90th percentile of earnings for a full-time salaried worker, currently $122,148 annually. The Department of Labor is seeking comment on whether to allow non-discretionary bonuses to satisfy a portion of the standard salary test requirement. It is also seeking comment on how best to update the salary level and the highly compensated employee total annual compensation level automatically each year. Two different methodologies are proposed for such updates. One would keep the amounts tied to the 40th and 90 percentiles of earnings for full-time salaried and workers, respectively. The other would adjust the amounts based on changes in inflation as measured by the Consumer Price Index. Notably, although the Department of Labor did not propose changes to the duties test in the NPRM, it is seeking comment on, quote, whether the standard duties test are working as intended to screen out employees who are not bona fide white-collar exempt employees, end quote. A number of commentators have expressed concern that the Department of Labor may include changes to the duties test in the final rule without considering public comment. Employers should now begin analysis of how the increased salary threshold will affect their current classification of employees as exempt or non-exempt. Some employees may need to be given a salary increase in order to remain exempt, and some employees may need to be reclassified as non-exempt. The NPRM is subject to a 60-day public comment period. Interested employers should provide their written comments before the deadline of September 4th. Comments may be submitted at www.regulations.gov. Following the comment period, the Department of Labor will issue a final rule, which must be reviewed by the Office of Management and Budget prior to the publication. The final rule is expected to become effective in mid-2016. And here is the hype for the Triangle. Triangle cities making headlines in recent national rankings. Number 3, Raleigh-Cary Metro ranks 3rd in U.S. for white-collar jobs creation from Forbes magazine. Number 4, Wake County's rank among the most digital counties from Government Technology. Number 10, Durham County's rank among the most digital counties, Government Technology publication. And number 11, Raleigh-Cary Metro ranks 11th in U.S. for population and high income growth from selfstorage.com. And number 14, North Carolina ranks 14th among states with the most female minimum wage workers from Forbes magazine. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at www.trianglereadingservice.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.